Do you love Making Movies Is Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show!
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast. I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, and Tubi!
Yay! I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. I'm currently making others. Let's see what happens. I'm a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage the Creative Distribution Initiative at Sundance. This Thursday bonus episode, we are going to play the interview from episode 331 with writer-director Jocelyn Rose Lyons, who came on the show to talk about getting her start as a director, making the move from the Bay Area to Los Angeles, among many other things. And we specifically chose this episode to pair with Saeed Crumpler because of the Bay Area connection and the connection to music. So it's a nice little marriage of minds. Well, before we get to the episode, just want to shout out our Patreon campaign, patreon.com/MMIH podcast. It is how we keep the show running. Check it out if you enjoy us. But without any further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Jocelyn Rose Lyons.
So we're here with Jocelyn Rose Lyons. Thank you so much, Jocelyn, for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to get right into it. Oh, wow. I mean, before we get into anything else, we want to hear about the Looking Glass. So give us the elevator pitch for Looking Glass.
Looking Glass is a mini short that I made right when the pandemic hit. Kind of, it was hitting festival circuit, and it's about kind of a portal to the past that can be accessed only through your hopes, dreams, or fears, really. It's an ensemble cast, all made up of, Oakland's own, Ryan Nicole Peters, DJ Umami. A lot of people know her as one of the DJs for the Golden State Warriors, DJ Ambush, and Jalal Malik, who came up actually from Los Angeles. I met him through one of our colleagues and friends, Mos Def, also known as Yasin Bey. And we created a really special piece as a community, shot it over at Bardo, which is a 1930s kind of supper club. So it really helped with the visuals. And it's a very mysterious piece. I'd love you guys to check it out. So.
How many days did you shoot?
It was actually a one-day shoot with 2 days of pickups. A very full one day. I think we were there probably a good 20 hours. But the call time was probably 6 or 7 a.m. And then we wrapped out probably around 9 or 10 by the time we all broke down everything. It was probably one or two. But yeah, it was a three-day total. The project went through a lot of rounds of posts because when we first started out, the project was not called Looking Glass. It was called, I'm blanking on the name. It was like something about following your dreams and how hard it is to do it. And then it just kind of evolved. And I think that's one of the biggest things I've learned as a filmmaker is to get out of my own way as best I can and allow the project to speak to me and tell me what it wants to be in terms of format, in terms of concept. I really, really learned that in this process writing a script that I just finished for my first feature. So, yeah.
And what was the rough budget of the film?
It was about, I don't know. I actually would be hesitant to even put that out there just because there was so many different phases of the budget. It's actually kind of hard to even say at this point, but, it was a labor of love. There was some funding that came through at different phases of the process. And I think the heaviest lift was actually, the production day itself, just in terms of the crew and the location fees and the equipment, all the logistics.
We're pretty tough on people with this question. Is there any way you can share, like, whether it's five figures or six figures? You could be vague as you want to be, just a little bit more detailed.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was, I would say, you know, because it's a mini short, it's actually a 5-minute piece. And when Sundance London like approached me and was saying, you know, Trey Ellis, who did Tuskegee Airmen, he's Peabody Award winning, he saw it. And he actually was the one who kind of wrangled the film over to Sundance London for its premiere there. But we had no intention to be honest about that budget of what our return on the investment was going to be, was to make a great piece that we really wanted in our portfolio. And for a lot of people, that doesn't sound like an incentive, like, oh, really? You just would want to do all that work to put it in your portfolio? But yes, that was actually our intention. My DP, Bosun Wang, he and I kind of sat down and I had the concept. Jalal was with us. He's a musician, rapper, actor, artist from LA. We all kind of just came together and decided to do this out of really a labor of love. So when Sundance London picked it up, or, you know, asked us to premiere it there, it was an honor and a real surprise. And what the film has done since then is beyond mind blowing for a 5-minute. And I say all that to say that I think we went into it thinking, well, we'll spend maybe, you know, a few thousand, and then we'll get a few thousand from here and there. And, you know, looking at the budget, we were thinking maybe it'd be about 20 grand, which is probably in the pocket of what we ended up spending in the first phase of the production. But, you know, the festival run was somewhat costly as well. You know, festival submission fees add up, and promotional materials, you know, cost. So, you know, I'd say give or take, but that's kind of where we started.
All right. Perfect.
Thank you for for adding that detail. How did you come up with the idea?
So, interestingly, the project, I think I kind of mentioned earlier in the answers that we started out working with Jalal actually on kind of a hybrid music video for a song he had, and that it was going to be both kind of speaking to the concepts in his song, and then at the same time speaking to some of these proof of concepts that I wanted to explore that I've been writing about in a script I just finished called Shadowbox. And so in some ways it was a hybrid project. So I wanted to explore time and memory in the context of portals to the past and kind of a period piece element, and just some of the concepts and themes I'm working on in my Shadowbox project that deal with time and time as a character. And so I've been saying this for some months now, probably over a year, I suppose, for press and whatnot, but Looking Glass was my love letter to time. And time is something that we never have enough of, or we always wish we could get back, or we just wonder what it's going to be like to have that one moment. Time is that elusive love that, you know, got away. It's like time is this thing. And so I wanted to, as a filmmaker, explore time kind of in a visual concept of portals and hopes and dreams and what it means to have a dream deferred. You know, speaking to Langston Hughes' deal on his amazing poem on time and what happens to your dreams over time when they're not nurtured and when you can't necessarily pursue them or you're not. So all that to say, a long-winded way of answering the question, which how I came up with the concept was really just working on Shadowbox, the script that's been a beast of a process to write, and wanting to explore kind of in a proof of concept way some of the themes in this piece, Looking Glass, as an exploration to exercise that creative muscle as a filmmaker with my team and with talent. About these concepts. And so it was that combined with Jalal and his interest in doing something as an artist. And that was how we kind of came up with the concept. But actually in post-production, the piece completely changed in terms of its format and its story beats and really its structure in post. So it was a complete evolution from what we began with to where it landed when the final locked picture happened.
And then how long did you spend working on the film from like its conception to it being released and doing its festival run?
Well, we shot it. It's really kind of shocking to hear this, but we shot it in the winter time of, I think I want to say 2018.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And in 2019, there was a lot of kind of back and forth around what we should do with it because of all of the above. And because it was a couple cooks in the kitchen, my editor, DP, Jalal, the performer, and who also was starring in the piece, and then my interest in having this exploration of these proof of concept ideas for my feature, that we all kind of had a different kind of feeling on what we should do with it. So we all just decided to let it kind of marinate over there. And we kind of honestly forgot about it for a while. And then the pandemic had kind of hit, and we'd been tinkering around with some edits and realized, you know, we got to just lock picture on this thing. Let's just see what we're going to do. So I want to say it was probably like late spring, early summer 2020 when we finally locked picture on it. And then it hit Sundance for its premiere that summer. And the past, wow, you know, 6 to 12 months. Yeah, it's been just traveling through the festival circuit, virtually speaking.
Wow.
Yeah.
Compared to all the other projects you've made, how difficult was this one?
This one was actually probably the longest winded project, considering or relatively speaking to its running time. In terms of difficulty, it was probably the easiest, maybe because of its running time. In terms of just getting it out to the world and dealing with promotional materials for it. I think the longer the piece, the more complicated it can be in terms of, you know, release forms and music licensing and promo materials. And when this 5-minute mini short, it was a breeze in a lot of ways compared to those hour and a half docs or television shows or series. So I really enjoyed the format in that sense. But interestingly, I've heard this a lot, that there's a lot of people that talk about, you know, don't make a short. I've literally heard this, and I'm not going to name names, but there's a very well-established director who said on a Clubhouse talk that I was in some months ago. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Clubhouse. It's like this audio creator app. And during the pandemic times, which I guess we're still in, of course, to some degree, but everyone was leaning on it, especially in the film circuit that I could see. A lot of people were in there just to kind of network and talk about projects and process. And so I found a lot of value there. And there was a director in there, and the director said that they don't believe in short films. And I was shocked that this director said this. And, you know, people kind of just ask the questions around like why and this and that. And they basically said, well, you know, it's just as much of a heavy lift to do a short as it is to do your feature. So if you're going to go through the motions, just do the feature. Well, yes, to some degree, that's true. And especially based on, you know, your question, Liz, around, you know, how would this project compare in terms of how hard it was to others? I think it had almost a 2-year from production to post to festival run in terms of its process. That could have been a feature. You know, it had a budget, it had a crew, it had post, it had all the same elements that we go through on a feature. So to some degree, yes, but I think there's great value in being able to exercise those creative muscles, so to speak, in a format that is short form, because it allows you and affords you a lot more room to play and to not have such a level of, the stakes are not as high, like you're not making this commitment to your feature film in so many different facets. So I think there's great value in being able to do it. And I also do think that it's, even though it shares the same playing field as a feature in terms of process, it's still definitely a much more approachable project to kind of take on if you want to make something. I think it's a really important tool that we have as filmmakers to say, I want to make a 3-minute short. I want to make, and there's micro festivals now. I mean, there's mini short, there's micro short. You can make 60-second shorts now, like you can shoot stuff on cell phones. I mean, I just believe that there should never be, you should never put yourself in a box. Like if you see a box, like, oh, this is how you should do it. then just learn how to scribble outside the box. And then you'll be a good filmmaker, you know? So that's my approach.
It's interesting that you say this because we've been having this debate with multiple guests in the last like 2 months or so where, you know, I think Liz and I have been talking about this over the last year or so about like, yeah, you should don't make too many shorts. Like just get onto your feature, you know, make one short or something, whatever, and just get to the feature. But then these other filmmakers are saying like, oh, well, we've had way more success with short films than we had with features. And like, you know, the recommendation from them was like, you know, don't make a feature right away, like get good at making shorts and have success with those. And then when the feature comes, that's right, then make the feature, you know, which is like completely backwards from how like I've been thinking in the last like year plus, you know. So it's very interesting. This debate continues, it goes, it churns.
Yes, but yeah. And I think they Ulrich, to your point, I actually think that both are true, as frustrating as it is to say it or to hear that. I think that both statements or thoughts around which is a better road to, if we're trying to, if we're talking about what is the vehicle, like if you look at other filmmakers, I'll just name some colleagues and friends in the Bay from Oakland, like Boots Riley and his Sorry to Bother You masterpiece, or Rafael Casal and David with Blindspotting. I mean, those were features. They both could have said, instead of making my first feature, I'm going to just do a short about these. And they could have had just as much success, but they went for the feature, and I applaud them for that. And I think that was the right choice. I think it's a matter of what is your goal at that time and really weighing that out. Like, are you looking for an agent? Are you looking for festival buzz? Are you looking for press? Are you looking for, you know, a vehicle that'll help you get a multi-year deal with a production studio where you can do a ton of other content? Or are you just trying to exercise some creative ideas? Like, really, I think it's asking ourselves what your motivation is. And I think that will help inform often whether or not you should spend the time to do the feature or do the short, or, you know, do both and just do them in that order. But yeah, I think they both exist. I think there's ways to the next step in doing either of them, short or feature.
Just jumping in here, because I was one of those people who was like, you should do the feature shoot. I was on the show as a guest, Making Movies is Hard. And Ulrich and Tim, the former co-host, asked me, and I was like, no, make the feature. And I've made two features. I'm now going to make a short next month, because I think there's this misconception that you make the feature to level up. And if you don't level up after two features, pointing at myself, there are other avenues that you're going to be trying that are maybe where the energy is, where the fun is, where the experimentation is. So just recognizing that I've noticed the error of my ways, and maybe this director will also stop shortchanging filmmakers by giving that advice.
Well, my whole point with it, it's just like, you know, like you can't really make a lot of money on a short. It's like a lot harder to turn a profit, you know? And it's hard to raise money no matter what you're doing, right? So like, I don't want to spend a lot of time raising money for a short that's like going to be, in my history, I made 7 short films and only one of them had any real success. So it's like, you know, I mean, I feel like the feature just seemed to make more sense for me right now. But if someone was to hire me to make a short, or if there was a budget to make a short, I would, hell yeah, I'd make a short. Shorts are fun. You know, they're fun. They're their own storytelling style. They are very unique. They're very different than a feature. And I feel like, you know, speaking to the other director you're mentioning, it's like, you know, sure, like it's hard to make a short, but like it's like 100,000 times harder to make a feature, having just done it for the first time and like, you know, just finishing up now. So, I mean, you know, it's definitely not exactly the same.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of times, I think what happens for us as filmmakers is we often judge the running time. If it's not a feature, we somehow see it as a dress rehearsal, you know, or it's practice for the big game. The performance is the feature, you know, that's the one, that's the playoff season, or that's, you know, the actual Broadway show. But truthfully, rehearsal could be either feature or short, and the performance could be either short or feature. I think they both can carry the same weight and standing in our industry because there's a place for both of them. But I think Ulrich, you're right. you just finished making a feature, and it's a much more time intensive and more complex project and process, I think, to make a feature than it is a short. If we're talking about which one is quote harder or, you know, yeah, requires more time, I would obviously say that features do.
Well,
for the most part, but
for me, it was like, so every film I've ever made has been emotional, right? It's all been like really hard and emotionally trying, but like the emotional aspect of making the first feature was like, for me, at least, it was so much higher. You know, I put so much stress and pressure on myself because it's like the first feature and you have to make it the best thing you possibly can. It's like going to only be your only first feature you'll ever have, you know? And so like, I just had this immense amount of pressure on myself, which I think hopefully people can take that off themselves when they go to make their movies, you know, because that's it's not that helpful, I think, sometimes.
It's not. And I think, unfortunately, when we do a bigger performance at a higher level, it obviously has a lot more value in the industry and a lot more of an ability to make an impression on our work or our signature style. And it's harder to undo it if it flopped, if it's a feature. It's harder to say, oh, well, that was just my feature. It wasn't, you know, but if it's a short, and you're like, oh, it was a short film. Like, what did you expect? I made a short. It's not supposed to be a feature. Yeah, it was supposed to flop, you know? But it's a little harder to have that little excuse when it's, you know, almost an hour and a half to 2 hours long, you know? So
I'm going to pivot us a little bit because I tend to come in with some annoying abstract questions, and I want to throw one in right now.
I like annoying and abstract questions.
Oh, good. Well, then you'll love me. If it's okay for me to say, I mean, you sound like an artist. You speak about filmmaking as if it has giving it the respect and credence that it deserves. Very often, I live in Los Angeles. I'm from the Bay Area, like you too, but I live in Los Angeles. Very often, we dispense with that kind of language and we talk about it as a commodity. And I just wanted to know, like, is there something that is giving you the confidence to maintain that look of art in that way? Or is it just something you've never even questioned?
I think that's a great question. It is quite abstract, which I love, not annoying at all. It's actually a brilliant question. I think that growing up in the Bay Area and in Oakland specifically, I think the Bay Area does support the arts in a really unique way. And the fabric of the community here, the culture here, the music, the art, the kind of the way in which, at least growing up for me, that my community really valued art first. Like there was actually a value for that. And it made me kind of, I guess, share in that it's valuable, the process, the journey, our spiritual connection to it all, or our creative process, that these are valuable things. And it wasn't a community, the Bay Area and Oakland specifically, growing up here, wasn't there wasn't a value system based on commodity or, you know, how is this going to look for your name to be next to it kind of thing. Like, it was really like, how are you growing and developing as a human being doing this project? And how are you feeling? Are you inspired? And there was such a collaborative spirit here growing up in the Bay that really reinforced that. And I do also say that, you know, my mom, she's an artist, and, you know, she raised my brother and I for the most part as a single mom growing up. So there was definitely like a level of that being instilled in us within the home. And then, of course, within Oakland and the community here too, around me. So I think that gives me a confidence because those are my roots. And I think our roots definitely help to, I guess, inform the fruit we bear to some degree. I think that those roots have given me confidence to value the process more so sometimes than the product, because I always say this, but this is a little long-winded, but I'll just say this, that if you look at a light artist like James Turrell, Drake, we all know him as a pop singer, artist, rapper, you know, he actually took some of that, Kanye's took some of James Turrell's work. We've all seen it in different music videos, but James Turrell is one of my personal favorite light artists. He takes light in the natural world and creates huge installations with this light, with this element of light. And if we look at his work, for example, as a filmmaker, if we can understand that our work is installation art, in a sense, yes, we think that our movies are forever, that everything lives on forever. It's so much more permanent. No, it's not. Everything is installation art to some degree. And that's just how I would like to see it. Because I think if you frame it that way, then you have to say to yourself, okay, then I better love this process. Because what I'm going to make may or may not sit in theaters very long, may or may not sit on television very long, may or may not, you know, make it to the internet in a certain way where it becomes viral or a part of our society or culture industry. So I have to love this process and this journey as an artist first and the most, because percentage wise, we spend most of our time in pre-production and production and post. And watching the final hour-long piece or two-hour-long piece or five-minute piece is a little tiny, you know, kind of end moment of that whole journey. So for me, I think it's also that. It's like approaching my art or my work as installation art to some degree reminds me when I frame it that way that, well, it can't be washed away by the ocean. It's not like a sculpture on the sand. To some degree, I really have to love building it because it's not necessarily a permanent thing. And the majority of my time and effort is going to be put into making it. So that's how I find value in it, because there's so much of the process that is based on the journey and not the product itself, which is, I think, just a byproduct of the journey. Like if you had a good journey, you'll probably have a good product. I think. I think so.
Yeah, I like that. That's like focusing on the process rather than the outcome, basically. And I think that's something I've been trying to do lately, or not lately, but like my whole career is like not worry about what festival it's going to get into, how many people are going to see it, whatever, but just trying to make it the best thing it can be, and like having that be the thing, and then move on to the next one, you know, and not dwell too much. So I want to go back to saying that you said like way early in the conversation, you just kind of casually dropped Mos Def as someone who connected you to one of your artists in your film, to your lead. And I have to pull on that a little bit. Like how are you connected to such a influential person? Like where does that connection come from?
So, it's interesting. I think my first doc feature, I made when I was 19, I want to say, or 20. It came out in 2003 in festivals, and then 2006 it was distributed. It was a hip hop film called Sounds of Spirit with a Z, S-O-U-N-D-Z. And it was about the spiritual connection and creative process and the journey in hip hop and just being an artist and why the process and journey is so important to value. And I interviewed a lot of artists in that film, Common, CeeLo, Quali, Andre 3000, KRS-One. It just had a really wide range. Shock G, rest in peace. Blackalicious, rest in peace, Tim. But it was a really a big production for me. I didn't know anyone in the industry. I hardly knew anyone in hip hop outside of the Bay Area. Del the Funky Homo Sapien and Hyro and a lot of Bay Area people were in the film as well. Guapale, Mystic. But I was really inspired at the time by Saul Williams and a film he had made called Slam. And I was also really inspired by the spoken word poetry movement. And I was involved with Youth Speaks, where Raphael Casal and David Diggs and all them were also doing their poetry stuff. So they were also, that was Raphael Casal's first film, was my first film. He was in it as a poet and I was making it. And we worked together ever since for years after that. But that kind of community led me to kind of a network of artists in hip hop that really became some of my colleagues for the past couple decades, really. And everything from music videos, directing for Quali, Black Star, Mos Def, and they had their group. A lot of artists locally like E40, who have obviously iconic national presence, Too Short, all them. But all that to say that my network, because of that film being the first kind of feature doc that I ever directed, it kind of introduced me to the film world through the lens of hip hop. And so from that point on, I started directing and making projects connected to the hip hop community and to artists from that genre of music for many years, from HBO Deaf Poetry to BET Networks. And so along that journey, that's where artists like a Mos Def or AKA Yasiin Bey kind of, I connected with them in different projects along the way. And those relationships, those connections really have lasted through time. And I look at them as a family. All the artists that I started out working with are really part of my family in film. And so then when, Mos Def was out here for the opening of an unveiling of a really beautiful piece at the MoMA in San Francisco. I want to say it was summer of 2018, maybe, or spring. So he came out for that. And he was also actually, I think, here for a show with Quali. I think they were doing some touring at the time. And so they performed, and then we went to the MoMA and looked at this artist, Julie. Her work was amazing, Julie Tamer. And Jalal was on tour with Mos Def and Quali, so he was kind of traveling around. And so he connected us at the MoMA, and kind of the seeds were planted, I think, at that moment for Looking Glass to some degree, because we were all talking about time and art and hip hop. And that's what Looking Glass turned out to be, a kind of love letter to time with elements of all the other things that I've talked about. So, yeah.
You're breaking my brain a little bit here. Like, I'm like so impressed by you. And I only understand half of your references because I'm a very boring white girl. And like, I'm just like, just like so thrown by this conversation, because everything you say takes me in somewhere else. Like, you talking about installation art really hit home. Like, I almost started to cry listening to you talk about it. And one of my questions was like, how do you, you know, we wrote this in advance of talking to you. It was like, how did you get representation? But now it's like, I think you go in a room, anyone would be like, please let me be on your team. I want to work with you.
I wish that was the case.
It is the case.
A lot of effort.
Yeah, no, you may not see that. That's definitely the case. So I know how you get it. But has it helped you is what I want to know. Has representation helped you? Sorry, that is a long question.
No, it has
very
not.
Self-serving.
No, it's a great question, but the answer is no, period. Representation has not helped me at all. and I'm laughing when I say it, because, you know, they say that the more truth is in a joke, the funnier it is. But yeah, I mean, representation, yes and no, of course. I mean, I'm being facetious. Like, representation has definitely helped. I recently just signed with ICM. You know, I think that it depends on how you use it. I think the truth is that it's always going to be your work first. And I've been a quote independent filmmaker my whole career. And I still see myself that way, even though I do have an agent now and whatnot. I think representation helps when you use it right, meaning you have to do the work and then know how to leverage that representation to help you with that work you've done. But I think that if I were to look at my representation as a gateway, it's not that. I think that the work is the gateway and the representation is maybe the chaperone. So I just try to see it in that sense. And I think to that degree, of course, it helps because it's someone helping escort your project along. But the gateway, or the thing that opens the gatekeeper, so to speak, is you, or is, you know, is me as the filmmaker. And the art itself is probably the road ahead that I want to be on. Like, that's what's actually going to take me. It's not necessarily the agent or the manager or, you know, the rep that you have. I think those are your entourage that come with you to help you open that big gate, you know, or walk with you down that very intimidatingly long new corridor that you've never been on before. So
now that you're with ICM, are they like helping you with your music video directing career, or are you like focusing like solely on narrative film? Is it everything? Like, what, like when you walked into the room and like, you know, you're meeting with your team, like what are you guys planning together to like for your future as an artist?
Right. Music videos were a big part of my filmmaking world for probably most of the, I'd say most of the later part of my 20s and early 30s, but then I kind of put them down. I mean, I haven't really directed music videos for a few years, and it was just kind of like an organic evolution. It was like, I loved the genre and I loved the format of short form. They're kind of like short films in a way, but I found the process a little limiting as a filmmaker, and it wasn't also a train I wanted to stay on. Like, I think there are people out there like Hannah Lux or even Vashti for a minute. And of course, Colin Tilley, who's actually an Oakland native as well, who have just mastered, like killed it in the music video world as directors. Yeah. And I think that if I wanted to be that type of filmmaker where I'm like, I'm just going to just focus only on this, then I would have stuck with it. So it's no longer something I'm really pursuing. And for the most part, I actually just turn down when I have offers from artists to do them. I pretty much decline just because it's not really my thing at the moment. I love Director X, amazing friend, colleague, artist. He's done incredible music videos. Taj, I mean, also from Oakland, Taj. But, you know, I feel like unless you're going to do it at that level, like, I'm out. Like, I don't want to just half step. Like, well, I kind of do music videos and I kind of do these. And, you know, those guys just have killed it. And they can do anything, you know, as well, of course. But I just kind of bowed out of that format and that genre. So to answer your question about representation, ICM now, I'm working on a deal right now. We're actually closing with Complex. It's a show I created with my one of my creative partners, Matt Barnes, who also has a podcast called All the Smoke with Showtime Sports. But we created the show, and we're going to be taking it over to Complex, and ICM is working on that with me and Matt. And yeah, my feature, my script. I'm really looking to make this movie soon. So that's definitely the high priority there, as well as a scripted as well. And the show with Complex is unscripted, but I'm more so interested in, yeah, I think either television or film, and narrative for sure. Scripted for sure.
In terms of sustaining your career, are you able to live based off of the money you make on your projects?
Yeah, I mean, I think commercial directing is definitely a better place to land for, you know, supporting your actual life and your bills. you know, independent filmmaking is not an easy road for you know, a financial return, unless your film hits the right place at the right time. And then, of course, you get a distribution deal or theatrical run, or, you know, virtually speaking in this day and age, like, have a really strong relationship with a distributor that has internet presence. But I think unless you have that kind of like studio attachment or distributor behind you, then the independent filmmaking route is a tougher place. So for me, it's been a combination of television and relying on the television networks to kind of to build that kind of financial return, and then commercial directing, which really is, I think, a really great place to also get creative within a certain container and exercise those muscles and sharpen those tools. I think commercial directing is really fun in that way because it's so focused, and it's also it pays a lot of bills. So yeah. Yeah. But television can too. You know, you direct a few episodes of a big series, or, I mean, those opportunities, I think those can be financially somewhat more rewarding than the independent filmmaking, of course. So
talk about your work in television. Like, what kind of stuff have you done? Have you been like directing episodes of shows, or like, you know, getting projects that you've made like licensed by networks? Like, what has the process been for that?
So I think when I was finishing my doc, my first doc, the one I mentioned earlier, Sounds of Spirit, I was really young. I think I was just about 20, 21 when it all went to festival. And at that same time, that's when HBO Deaf Poetry, I started working with Simmons Latham Media Group and BET Networks. And I mean, I pretty much stuck with that Viacom world, especially with BET, for maybe 10 years producing and directing content. I directed and produced their first Music Matters showcase at for the Grammys at CAA in LA. I produced the BET Celebrity Basketball Game. That was with Nick Cannon and Chris Brown and Angela Yee. But, you know, a lot of the music television I produced spanned, I would say, a good decade and a half. I mean, I stuck with it for a long time. Everything from segment producing to just directing, like I said, showcases live with multicam setup for, you know, streaming, all kinds of television. And I enjoyed it. I mean, I love producing and directing in the land of TV. But most of it was music based or music television based with the Viacom, mostly BET networks, some things for MTV, VH1, all that, but it's mostly been that. And then a lot of documentaries. I mean, I've produced and worked on a ton of docs that went to, you know, like Misrepresentation, that went to Oprah Winfrey Network. There's been a ton of docs I've done more recently that actually premieres tonight in Oakland, is Speaking Truth to Power, which is a doc feature that's going to be on Starz Network a little later in the year. That has Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Of course, it's about Barbara Lee, Van Jones, Cory Booker, Danny Glover, Alice Walker. Amazing, amazing cast. And there's been other docs, too, that have landed in television, like The Message on BET, which is like Nas, Snoop Dogg, just like an amazing array of talent. I worked on the Hip Hop Chess series for BET Networks with RZA and GZA, Wu-Tang Clan. So a lot of the television I've done over the years has truly been music, hip hop, and then documentary, of course. And now, you know, like 2 years ago, I want to say, I created a show and executive produced a series with Matt Barnes, my creative partner, for LeBron James Network, Uninterrupted. It's his digital platform. And it was called Same Energy. It was just kind of about similar themes to your podcast, like about what it takes to, you know, persevere and succeed to following your dreams and how hard it can be to do it. But in the context of sports specifically and music. So we interviewed 2 Chainz and Marshawn Lynch here from Oakland. But so that series went to Uninterrupted, did really, really well.
I think it's yeah. time for final 5 questions.
Yay,
you're almost done. So first question is, what's the first film you ever made? You could define that however you'd like. It could be something that no one ever saw, something that played Sundance London. Obviously, you made films before that. What's the first film you ever made? How do you feel about it now?
The first film I ever made was Sounds of Spirit. Although right before that, I was actually interning and then PAing at a production company when I was still in college and Paradigm Productions. And we worked on a doc film for Discovery Channel called VLT. It was a very large telescope. It was like the largest telescope in the world, like 5 football fields long or something. So I did dabble as, you know, kind of a background player in a few docs and some films before my first feature. But my first feature doc was Sounds of Spirit. And it won Best Music Documentary at the New York International Film Festival. It premiered HBO Urban World. It got a distribution deal through Ventura, which was a division of Paramount at the time. It was released internationally on DVD with an original soundtrack I produced. And I feel great about it, even 20 years later, dang near. So I'm happy that was my first film because it was an amazing project and process.
Wow. I wish we could talk to you for another hour. What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
I think it was from Jean-Pierre Jeunet. He did Amelie, which is one of my personal favorite films in the whole world. That next to Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, and there's a few others. But I love Amelie. It uses magical realism in an amazing way. It's a French film. It took him over 10 years to make the movie. It won a ton of awards. In my opinion, it was his magnum opus. But he came to screen it, and I had a chance to ask him during our Q&A a question. Actually, it wasn't Amelie. He screened Micmac. It was a film after Amelie, but I wanted to ask him a question about Amelie. So I asked him, I said kind of that question, like, what is your best advice for a filmmaker? And I think his advice was maybe the best advice I've ever heard, which was, you know, use everything in your toolbox, everything. Like in Amelie, if you look at that film, the storytelling techniques are so limitless. Like he used archival B-roll, like that someone was watching on TV green screen clearly, with like incredible little animation of characters that were like turning light switches on, to just amazing use of rotoscoping and layered all kinds of storytelling techniques within that one movie. And he said, just use everything in your toolbox as a filmmaker. And I think that that's in every phase of the process too, not just in production or post. It's like in pre-pro and writing and outreach, like don't leave any stone unturned, so to speak. And actually Sundance Collabs, I got involved with them and they kind of had the same thing. Eric Eason over there said kind of a similar thing, you know, just use everything that you have, all the resources you can think of.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
I think my goal really is, as abstract of an answer as this is to continue to shine my light through my work, and in that process help to spark that same kind of ignite that same light in other people so they can learn to shine theirs. Because I think our job as human beings first is that we're beings of light, and our job is to shine our light and not dim it, not try to play small. You know, it's very easy to not think of yourself as the someone that has the ability to radiate light or illuminate light. And even if it's just enough light to help you know what step to take next. Like, you might not have enough light to like illuminate the whole journey ahead where you can see miles away, but just enough light to just keep going. Like that, I would like to be able to continue to shine my light, my journey, so that it can help others like learn to shine theirs.
Wow. Amazing answer, by the way. If you could go back in time, what's one piece of advice you would give yourself?
There was a period of time when I was struggling to believe that there was any value in making the feature that I really wanted to make. And so I kind of put it down for a few years. And I think I needed to do that. But I think I would have, if I could go back, I would tell myself to just have patience, keep persevering, and keep praying, and just keep going, you know, because that little pocket of time, in some ways I abandoned the script. And like I said, I think that was part of the process, because what it became when I picked it back up again was a beast. Like, I didn't write that film. I didn't write that script. I was literally a vessel, and I just had good antennas that helped me download all the ideas. that was it. But I don't think that my antennas would have been able to get the download for me to be the vessel to write the script had I not taken the years away from it and felt very, you know, pessimistic and disheartened by everything at that time. So, you know, in some ways I'd give myself that advice to just keep believing at that time and just keep going, and that my ideas were worth something to continue to do. But at the same time, I had to go through that fire for the diamond to be made, so to speak, of that project. So I wouldn't take it back either necessarily.
Last question, is making movies hard?
The reason I said yes to all Rick's requests to do this interview is because yes, movie making is very, very difficult. And when Blindspotting actually did its Oakland premiere at the Grand Lake Theater, which is where I'm going to be premiering a doc that I helped produce tonight, it's on my Instagram page way back in my history from like 2018, July, that summer, that Blindspotting, the movie, not the series, it's now out on Stars. I sound like I work for them, but I don't. I just love them. They're my family. But what David Diggs and Raphael said on stage when they first got up there was the exact phrase, making movies is hard, man. That was literally how they opened up their speech. And so when Ulrich said it to me, I was like, of course I have to do this. Yes, movie making is really hard. And making movies is definitely a difficult task. And I think that that's what separates a real, quote, real artist with someone who just likes the idea of it or is seduced by the industry around it, is that if you really have a calling to be a filmmaker, then even when it gets hard, you can't put it down. And if you do, that little knock on that door is going to grow louder and louder and louder until you pick it back up. It's like a baby crying, because it's part of your mission or your calling here. And that's the difference. If you really can put it down and walk away, to me, you weren't really meant to be a filmmaker then.
So. Wow. Awesome. Jocelyn, thank you so much for coming on the show. I mean,
thank you so much for having me. It was amazing.
You like speak poetry when you talk.
So wonderful.
It's incredible.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It was so fun talking to you guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, break a leg tonight. Oh, go on.
Thank you.
Where should people go to find out more about you? Like, is your Instagram the best place? Do you have a website? Like, where do you want people to go if they're like, you know, want to learn more about you after listening?
I think that, my website, it's Jocelyn Rose, or my Instagram, it's Jocelyn Rose. I try to post things there, here and there. So, I think those are the best spots to find out more about me.
All right, Ulrich, blast from the past. If Jocelyn was on the show today, what is the one question you'd ask her?
I would ask Jocelyn, well, first, I haven't talked to her in a really long time because, like, since we were paired on this one project at my company, we weren't paired up again, unfortunately. So I'd probably just want to know how she's doing. But then I saw that she's like directing some sort of Showtime documentary show or something, which is really cool. So like, I'd probably ask her about that. I think it's I'm getting my wires crossed. That someone else is doing the Allen Iverson thing. But I think she's doing some sort of Showtime something or other. So that's really cool. But yeah, I'd probably just see how she's doing and see what's going on. I know that she was going to be potentially a member of the Academy. I want to find out if she actually became a member. Yeah, I want to catch up with Jocelyn. I just want to hear what Jocelyn's up to. But yeah, what about you? What would you ask Jocelyn if we had her on today?
Just feel like anything we asked her, she came back with just like so much like meat on the bone. I don't know. It was like there was always like an amazing answer. So I think anything we ask would be a fruitful discussion. I really want to know what's up with her and like what's happened since we talked to her. I also remember the way she talked about exhibition and art and having it, you know, how art can be ephemeral. Like she was talking about like the beach and the waves on the sand and moments and experiencing art in like a very like impressionistic way. And I would love to talk more about that because I just loved that conversation so much. So I would be happy talking about the weather with Jocelyn Rose Lyons if she wanted to talk about the weather. Really anything.
I remember now like being on the interview with her and she's like, wow, she's get deep and like all this artistic, creative, like, you know, ideas and thoughts and like passion. And I was like, man, where's my passion? I don't think about that. I should be thinking about these things. This is incredible. But yeah, if you guys have a question for us, a comment or a suggestion, you can send us an email at podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Do you like these bonus episodes? This is the second one that we've done. We actually haven't even released the first one as of the time of this recording, so I don't even know if they're successful or not yet. But yeah, let us know what you guys think. You can also leave us a review on iTunes, which would be really helpful. We already have our first of 2023, so you could be the second. Also, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our bonus episode editor, Jeff Vrijmoot, who's the same editor for our regular episodes.
Jeff!
For doing the editing. Yay! He also edited last week's bonus episode, which I said I was going to edit, but then I actually asked him to edit it, and he just did it. So I should not have any credit for last week's episode. Also, a big thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome, and we will see you guys all on Monday.